This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
And with that, you've been listening to a rebroadcast of the evening news, con su edición en español, informativo. Y ahora es medianoche en punto, exactly 12 midnight, on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And that means that, with any luck at all, it's time for this. Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Coming, little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Fire's coming, swords are coming, pistols, guns, and knives are coming, famine's coming, famine's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Coming, little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Slavery's coming, thievery's coming, plunder's coming, wonder's coming, jobbing's coming, rabbin's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Fears are coming, tears are coming, plague and pestilence are coming, Satan's coming, Satan's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming. Little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming. Little know ye who's coming, little know ye who's coming. Little know ye who's coming, if John Quincy not be coming.
All right, a little open up with some campaign music from 1828 here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Listener supported, non-commercial, WBAI. Welcome aboard. My name is Bill Weinberg. We're going to continue tonight with here in the final two-week countdown to the presidential race, polling the audience on your views on the election and who you're planning on voting for and why is my first question, which I'm going to put to all of you. Or if you're going to vote, because maybe some of you are not going to vote, made a conscious decision to abstain. And secondly, if you are anticipating an October surprise in the remaining, 2 weeks of October? Less than 2 weeks now of October, remaining 10 days of October. If you're anticipating an October, or maybe it'll be an early November surprise. And if so, what is it going to look like? Well, the music which we opened with, actually I got this from Tom Whisker. He's been playing it a lot on his show. His show is Weaponry, immediately following this show, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, as you longtime listeners will know. And the name of the record is Presidential Campaign Songs, 1789 to 1996, sung by Oscar Brand. And they're all extremely historically didactic. That one was from... that one was called Little Know Ye Who's Coming, words from the Cincinnati Gazette of July 30th, 1828, as adopted by Oscar Brand. And the election of that year was a contested election, by the way, and an extremely... critical. Actually, you know, it was the one before that. It was 1824, actually, John Quincy Adams' first term, which was the critical contested election, which sort of established the two-party system, which we know and love today in this country. And here's how it went down. In 1824, John Quincy Adams was elected by the House of Representatives after he failed to win a majority in the Electoral College, following a four-way race with Andrew Jackson, William Crawford, and Henry Clay. Henry Clay was then Speaker of the House and assumed the role of kingmaker to arrange Adams' ascension to the White House. Adams then made Clay Secretary of State, but they both always insisted there was no deal. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, right? Betrayed, Jackson broke with the Democratic Republicans, then the major opposition to the Federalist, to found the Democratic Party, which catapulted him to the presidency in 1828 and is still with us today. And the Democratic Republicans, after backing Henry Clay's unsuccessful bid to reclaim the presidency from Jackson in 1832, became the Whigs, which after splitting over the issue of slavery gave birth to the Republicans in 1854, bringing us once again the two-party system which we know and love today. So the reason that there's, you know, little know ye who's coming or what's coming if John Quincy not be coming, slavery's coming, guns and knives and swords are coming, blah, 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 blah. Basically, anarchy is coming. Was because, Andrew Jackson was perceived as the leader of the rabble and the scum and the lowest elements of society, as opposed to John Quincy Adams, of Massachusetts, as opposed to Jackson, the frontiersman from out in the sticks in Tennessee. John Quincy Adams was perceived as being, you know, the exemplar of responsible government and the blue bloods and the patricians, and so on. And this really, finally, Jackson's victory brought about the split in the Democratic-Republican Party. And prior to that point, the two-party system had been the Federalist, which was the party of, once again, of the blue bloods and the patricians and the bankers and the moneyed interests and New York City's own Alexander Hamilton. And John Quincy Adams' father, John Adams, was also a Federalist, second president. They were, on one hand, you know, they were the urban interests and the moneyed interests and big business, as opposed to the Democratic Republicans, who were the frontiersmen and the farmers and the rabble and the hicks and the slave owners, in a very ironic circumstance of American politics, which in some ways, with a few twists and turns, persists to this day, where You know, basically you've got two parties which represented two different factions of the elites, but their rhetoric played to either appealing to or appealing to fears of the mob and to fears of the Democratic Republicans, consciously playing to fears of elitism and urbanism, whereas the Federalists were playing to fears of the people who were afraid of elitism and urbanism, who were perceived as, you know, being the unwashed masses, and particularly, you know, the rural redneck elements of the day. So when Andrew Jackson won in 1828, right? When Andrew Jackson won, the Democratic Republicans split because it was perceived that the rabble had finally won the day and taken over the party. So the more patrician elements of the Democratic Republicans, the more sort of, you know, landed gentry, the Madisonian elements of the party, split and merged with the elements of the Whigs to form, merged with the elements of the Federalists to form the Whigs, who became the new two-party system. And then the Whigs themselves, so then it was the Whigs and the Democrats for, about 40 years, until the Whigs themselves split over the issue of slavery, and the Abraham Lincoln faction of the Whigs took over and formed the Republican Party, and the rest of the Whigs kind of disappeared from the stage of history with the Civil War. And we've got the, once again, the two-party system that we know and love today. So, you know, there's been these strange permutations, but essentially it's kind of, in some ways, you know, everything has completely changed in this country. Obviously, I mean, the two parties have sort of done a complete flip-flop, and now it's the Republicans who are the heir to the Whigs and to the Federalists, who are appealing to small-town America and real America, as Sarah Palin puts it, and to the rural vote, and to suspicion of the elites, and to suspicions of urbanism and cosmopolitanism. Whereas it's the Democrats now who have stepped into the role of John Quincy Adams and Alexander Hamilton as the representative of urban elitism, and yet there's still the same sort of rhetoric which is being invoked that the Democratic Party is, as then exemplified by Andrew Jackson, and today exemplified by Barack Obama, is the party of, terrorism. And there's fears of the rabble on both sides. Obviously, it's playing different ways. You know, it's playing Sarah Palin and her crew are appealing to fears of us urban rabble, as it were. Whereas back then in that song, in that campaign song for John Quincy Adams, they were definitely appealing to urbanites' fears of the rural rabble. But it's still very much the same kind of sentiment. So, the Democratic Republicans were still tarred with the contagion of revolutionary France, in much the same way that Obama is today being tarred with far less reason, by the way, with the contagion of socialism and communism and Muslim extremism, Islamic extremism. Which is, of course, would be a complete contradiction, even if there were any political logic to it at all, which there isn't. So, once again, some very strange permutations, which the which the party system has gone through in this country over the past 200 years and change in certain points of complete reversal and other strange points of continuity. Very, very odd indeed. So, there's other songs which I want to play from this after I do a little bit of ranting and take your phone calls. We'll take a musical break. We'll leave a full hour for phone calls if all goes according to plan. We'll take a musical break at in about 10 or 15 minutes. And then we'll poll you, the listeners, on, once again, my two questions is, how are you intending to vote and why? Or are you, in fact, intending to vote? Or are you intending to just abstain on principle? Or perhaps not on principle, but just because you're disillusioned with the whole thing and you're, too apathetic to vote. I suppose there's a spectrum there between what constitutes a principle and what constitutes merely being disillusioned. That's the first question. And the second question is there going to be an October surprise in the remaining 2 weeks? And what is it going to look like? So maybe in around 15 minutes, we'll take your calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. So, I just got back from the from Andrew Kleinman's lecture tonight about the a Marxist analysis of the financial crisis, and there was a lot of talk there, of course, about the electoral race and the obvious parallels to the 1930s with the crisis which we're looking at now. We'll see if, in fact, it's going to get that bad, but certainly everybody's saying that it's certainly the worst financial crisis since the 1930s. And there is a potential, at least, for the economic system to actually freeze up the way it did in 1929. We're seeing perhaps the biggest direct state intervention in the financial system since FDR's day. And it's ironic that it's happening under a conservative Republican regime, which has touted the dogma of laissez-faire and deregulation for the entire generation that it's been in power, really, the only democratic interregnum we had were the Clinton years, in which, we got into NAFTA and we got into the World Trade Organization, and we did away with welfare as we know it, quote unquote. So Clinton, despite the fact that he was so demonized by the right in this country as a so-called socialist or even a liberal, essentially bought into all of the economic precepts of the of the Reagan Revolution. So just like, Nixon back in the early 1970s said, we're all Keynesians now, because, it was just taken for granted that even though he was a Republican, a framework had been established in this country with FDR and the New Deal, that there was going to be some, state regulation of the economy and something of a social safety net and so on. And that really wasn't overturned until Reagan. So even though Clinton was from the other party, he well could have said, we're all Friedmanites now. And I'm talking about Milton Friedman, not Friedman from the New York Times. So so really you could say that this, Reaganite regime has been in power for a full generation now. And I include the Clinton years because that's a part of how skewed things have gotten in this country over the past generation since Reagan, when everything, turned around in 1980. Really was the Reagan-Thatcher revolution And it was a global revolution, and it was the beginning of the big thrust of globalization, which is still with us today, and which, you know, went right on through with NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and European unification. And arguably, you could see the final militaristic neocon intervention thrust of the past 8 years as being a part of that as well. And finally, you know, overturning some of the last holdout regimes out there, which were not playing ball with, letting down all of the restrictions to trade and still maintaining state control of resources and so on, most notoriously in the case of Saddam Hussein. So, ironically, you know, it's an indication of how skewed the whole political vocabulary has gotten this country over the past 25 years, 30 years since the Reagan Revolution, that that Clinton was, you know, so mercilessly baited by the right in this country as a communist and a socialist. even as he was playing right along with all of the basic precepts of Reaganism to a T. So, you know, it's like I always say, if Poland has got anti-Semitism without Jews, then the United States has got anti-communism without leftists. And that brings us to the current situation where we're at, where we seem to be at a real turning point. You know, probably the third big turning point in this country since FDR. You know, I mean, first we had, FDR was the big turning point away from laissez-faire, hands-off, let the pigs run wild capitalism of the 1920s, and towards a more state interventionist system, which persisted right on through to the Reagan era. And then in the Reagan Revolution of 1980, that was decisively overturned, and the conventional wisdom was, state regulation has sort of outlived its usefulness, and we can never have another depression. We can never have another financial crisis of the scale of what we saw in the 1930s. And we don't have to worry about that kind of thing anymore. So down with the regulations, let the pigs run wild once again. The magic of the market will take care of everything. And that persisted from 1980 right up until now. And now we're potentially, once again, at the point of a major turning point, and it's going to be very interesting to see which way it goes. Because already, even this Republican regime has taken big state interventionist measures. Now, Andrew Klein was very, the big point which he emphasized tonight is that Bush is doing what he is doing, in terms of, you know, bailing out Wall Street to the tune of $700 billion, not to, obviously not to help the little guy, not even to make a much of a pretense of helping the little guy as FDR did. And we'll get next. I have a few things to say about the legacy of FDR, but first let me just to very briefly sum up what Andrew Klein had to say. And I should emphasize that a lot of what he said simply went over my head, because I'm not very well versed in all of this economic gobbledygook. And maybe we'll try to get him on the radio to talk about it in very simple terms, and with somebody who is naive as myself about economic jargon interviewing him, perhaps he can try to put it into terms which are more comprehensible for the layperson. Once again, basically his point is that this isn't, Bush is doing what he's doing not because of ideology, but in spite of ideology. And the situation does not or does not yet represent an ideological shift. And Bush, in fact, is not even doing it contrary to a lot of propaganda on the left. Bush is not even doing it to help his friends on Wall Street. It's not even about, you know, saving his fat cat friends. It's about saving capitalism. And there really is a, right now we're actually looking at a fundamental crisis of the system. And there really is the possibility that the entire economic system is going to freeze up and that capitalism is simply going to cease to function. And it really, we could really be at the point of collapse, and then the game will be over for everybody. So, really what Bush is trying to do here with this bailout, and this bigger than just Bush, what the entire political establishment really globally is trying to do, is not to, not even to save the position of the rich in this country, but to save the system itself, to save capitalism itself. So, that brings us to what's going to happen next, and it's going to be very interesting to see which way the election is going to go, because you know, even John McCain and Sarah Palin are talking out of both sides of their mouths. And on one hand, they're continuing to tout the Reaganite hands-off dogma, and on the other hand, they're making these noises about you know, we're going to get tough on Wall Street and we're going to help out the little guy. At the same time that they, you know, continue to socialist bait and communist bait, and basically red bait Barack Obama. There's a real contradiction here, you know. So, they're looking inconsistent, I think, because they're being extremely inconsistent. You know, they're continuing to, engage in the same kind of red baiting rhetoric, just like Newt Gingrich did against Clinton, more than 10 years ago now. At the same time that of necessity, they're having to throw around populist, help out the little guy, get tough on Wall Street rhetoric themselves. So, they really don't have much of a program. I think a lot of people are going to realize that they don't have much of a program. So, things seem to be tilting rapidly towards Barack Obama. Okay, then there's the question of Barack Obama, and what does he represent? Well, you know, a lot of people at Andrew's gig tonight made the requisite noises that you know, Barack Obama is just trying to save the system as well. That's also a line which I've gotten from the last time which we took phone calls on this question. I got from a lot of listeners. Is that, you know, FDR was just trying to save capitalism back in the day, and Barack Obama essentially represents the same agenda, and, you know, we shouldn't get taken in by it. And, well, you know, we're yet to see if, you know, Barack Obama is even going to go nearly as far as FDR did, or will have occasion to, because thus far, certainly, the financial crisis has not caused a general economic freeze-up such as happened in 1929, although there's been a lot of talk about that. And there seem to be, I mean, if people in high places have actually broached the possibility, then that's certainly reason to be scared. But certainly, you know, Barack Obama is talking a good game anyway. He's talking a much better game than John McCain and Sarah Palin are. And he's certainly at least sounding more or less consistent on the issues. I have to admit that I'm kind of torn on this question. Because on one hand, well, yes, it can't be denied that, you know, the historical function of the New Deal and, you know, FDR's place in history was to save capitalism. And I don't think that, you know, he would have equivocated on that or did. I don't think that he did equivocate on that, you know, in any sense, despite the fact that he in his own day was also mercilessly socialist baited. And on the question of October surprises, we could talk about the Smedley-Butler affair, when the hero Marine Smedley-Butler was approached by a bunch of conservative industrialists who felt that the New Deal was creeping socialism. And essentially, they asked him to lead a military coup d'etat against FDR. Back in, I believe, this probably would have been 34 or thereabouts. And Smedley Butler, to his everlasting credit, told them to go to hell. And in fact, went to the press with the with their offer, and there was a big scandal about it, and which became known as the Smedley Butler affair. So there was actually, you know, the possibility. And this is sort of like a something nobody ever likes to talk about, right? But there was actually the possibility of an actual, you know, right wing military coup d'état in the United States under FDR. It's 12:30 in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg, and this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. So even though FDR was, and, you know, he himself was a, you know, a blue blood and a patrician and a scion of the elite, and quite clearly was attempting, successfully, to save capitalism, that was not how it was perceived by a lot of the conservative industrial elite in the country at the time, to the point that not only was he bitterly opposed by the Republicans in Congress and by elements of the judiciary, and that, you know, certain, I mean, the WPA was overturned by the Supreme Court and so on. But the most bellicose and reactionary members of the ruling elites actually attempted to pull off a coup d'etat, an actual coup d'etat. I'm not using the word in a hyperbolistic sense, but in the most narrow and literal sense. So, and this, you know, brings us to the question of what's going to happen in the next, in the next 14 days. And to tell you the truth, I'm going to be breathing a sigh of relief, I confess, in spite of everything, Obama is elected. But then, you know, that remains to be seen of what's going to happen before he takes the oath of office. And of course, we're never really out of the woods because we're going to see what's going to happen once he's actually in office. But, you know, even if we don't have an October surprise, maybe it'll be a November or a December surprise. And there will be some kind of emergency which could be used as a pretext or an opportunistic moment to postpone the transfer of power, which, as you recall, here in New York City, Rudolph Giuliani proposed after 9/11 for himself. Now, obviously, that's not nearly the same thing as actually doing on a nationwide level. So, I mean, it's, you know, people kind of tiptoe around these issues, right? But, you know, I'm kind of putting the cards on the table tonight and talking about the things which I actually fear. Okay, so all right. Once again, getting back to the FDR analogy, one of the things which I heard from listeners, or a particular listener, the last time that we took phone calls on this issue was, you know, making the point that, you know, FDR saved capitalism, and that, you know, the New Deal was all about shoring up the system and co-opting revolutionary currents. Well, the point that was made, which I could take issue with, was that, you know, when he was elected, back in 32, you know, there were militant strikes going on all over the country and workers were taking over the factories and so on. And then he came to power and they all got bought off. Well, that actually doesn't stand up. You know, I've been that didn't sound right to me at the time. And I checked up on it. And in fact, it's totally wrong. Now, yes, the historical role we can see in retrospect, okay, was of FDR and the New Deal was to save capitalism. And basically the big, big government, intervention in the economic system was necessary to ride out the tremendous crisis, a profound crisis of the 1930s. And you could argue that FDR was one exponent of that and that Hitler and Mussolini were also exponents of that, because they also basically had sort of Keynesian economic programs, along with, you know, war and genocide and the Blitzkrieg and so on. They both believed in state intervention in the economy on a massive scale, you know, state capitalism, if you will. A sort of a partnership between the one-party state and private capital, and something of a, I mean, remember, people throw the word fascism around like a manhole cover, just as a sort of an all-purpose insult on the left, just as the way the right throws around the word socialist without any appreciation for its meaning, or even liberal without any appreciation for its meaning. People on the left who, you know, treat the word fascism the same way forget that there was, when I'm talking about, you know, narrowly defined fascism, classical fascism of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, there was a big populist element to it. And Hitler and Mussolini both very, very much appealed to the little guy, once again, you know, against the elites, ironically. And actually, you know, did put in place something of a social safety network for the disenfranchised middle class. So, you know, there was this big crisis in the, profound crisis of capitalism in the 1930s, and, you could, not even looking at it as a design, but simply looking at it in terms of systems analysis, and from the looking at it from the principle of the function of a system is what it does, fascism was one mechanism for riding out that crisis and preserving the system, and so was the New Deal. And if you have to, you know, pay your money and make your choice between fascism and the New Deal, well, overwhelmingly, the left in this country, supported the New Deal. And overwhelmingly, the left around the world supported the Allies in the Second World War. Now, we're allowed to have our own critique of those choices which were made from the perspective of more than half a century later. But nonetheless, it's a fact that that happened. And while we can correctly view the New Deal as a mechanism for riding out the crisis, we shouldn't be too mechanistic about it either. And it's simply an historical fallacy to say that in 1932, workers were taking over factories and then they all got bought off when FDR came to power with the New Deal. Because actually, it sort of worked the other way around. The absolute worst years of the Depression, from 1929 to 1933, people were really beaten down, and there wasn't a lot of labor militancy in this country. There was a lot of hopelessness and despair. And really, the high noon of labor militancy in the 1930s coincided with the high noon of the New Deal. The San Francisco general strike was 1934. And the real big instance of workers taking over factories in this country was, of course, the General Motors strike of 1936 to 37, where the plants in Michigan were massively occupied by the UAW workers. So it corresponded with the height of the New Deal, when FDR was riding high. That was the high noon of the labor militancy of the 1930s. And in fact, the workers at the General Motors plants, they were sort of felt that they were, you know, putting FDR to the test, and they were sort of pushing the envelope on his program and making sure that he was going to walk the walk and live up to his own rhetoric, of course. But nonetheless, they basically supported the New Deal program from everything which I read, and I've kind of got up to speed on it over the course of the past couple of weeks. Particularly, you know, that strike, the UAW strike of 36-37, was the big test of the New Deal labor legislation, which guaranteed, particularly the Wagner Act, which guaranteed the right to collective bargaining. And it won. You know, they, in fact, General Motors blinked and did recognize the UAW's right to collective bargaining in the end. And it was the first big test of the FDR labor legislation, and it passed the test. So Well, what does all this have to do with the situation that we're in today in this country? Well, there's a part of me, okay? There's a part of me which perfectly recognizes that the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party, is a party of corporate power, that they're both parties of corporate power. And that probably the bulk of the big corporate money now and the Wall Street money is going to Barack Obama, because he is correctly perceived as the one who's got some kind of a program which can shore up the system and see to it that capitalism survives. And probably it's only the most reactionary and intransigent elements of particularly the resource industries, and particularly oil, which are behind the other guy, John McCain, who are particularly wedded to dropping environmental regulations and restrictions on oil drilling and opening up public lands to resource exploitation. Probably that's the only sector of corporate power which is, and that's a very significant sector of corporate power, of course, but it's not the only sector, right? And probably the entire rest of the corporate power structure in this country, and particularly that wing more wedded to finance capital, is behind Barack Obama. And it's only, the real resource industries which are behind John McCain at this point. So, I recognize all of this, absolutely. And yet, there's also a part of me which sort of feels like, even anarchists like Carlo Tresca finally, at the end of the day, got on board with the New Deal and with the Allies in the Second World War. And there were historical reasons for that. And it was only the absolute most intransigent elements out there who ultimately did not get on board with the Popular Front and the New Deal and the Allies. They were, certainly by the Second World War, they were a lonely few. Like Maria Berneri, if I've got her name right, in England, who remained intransigently opposed to the Allies and to the war effort to the very end. But they were a lonely few. So to a certain extent, I sort of feel that we're in a similar situation today, except that the left is much, much, much weaker today than it was in the 1930s, obviously, which puts us in an even worse position vis-a-vis corporate power. And if corporate power, if the left, the international left, got bought off by the New Deal and the Popular Front in the 1930s, then how much easier is it going to be for us to take the bait today, when essentially there is no left? And we can fool ourselves all we want that there's a left, but there really isn't much of a left left. Certainly, any comparison with the 1930s has got to, start right front and center. You had a big, strong, united, militant left in the 1930s, and you've got practically none in this country today. So where does that leave us between, but in terms of, having to make our choices in the voting booth, or not in the voting booth, for those of you who are going to maintain a hardcore abstentionist position? A big part of the thinking around this as well is that the way Barack Obama and Sarah Palin have been playing abjectly and so blatantly to ugly America And, you know, not only the incessant red baiting of Barack Obama, but at a very minimum, accepting all of the really, really ugly race baiting, which has been following, particularly Sarah Palin's campaign trail. And Sarah Palin has really said nothing about all of the, you know, the actual death threats which have been issued at her rallies. And McCain has only issued the most lukewarm and perfunctory disavowals of that kind of rhetoric. And when I hear a Sarah Palin talking to a rally in Greensboro, North Carolina, which to me immediately recalls the Ku Klux Klan massacre, which took place there in 1979, and says things like, oh, it's so good to be out here where people are pro-America, it gives me a great deal of pause in terms of what this country could be in for if these guys get elected. And once again, you know, the same kind of is why I opened with that song from John Quincy Adams, you know. The same kind of terrorism baiting which the patrician elements used against Andrew Jackson in that election with John Quincy Adams back in 1824. Now, you know, ironically, Sarah Palin is using in barely veiled terms, and or not veiled terms at all, in playing to the rural rabble, so to speak, sounding like an arrogant New Yorker, to play the fears of us, of you and me, of us, you know, urbanites and whining minorities and people who aren't perceived as being real Americans and not being pro-America. So, you know, in some ways, there's, you know, a very, very clear-cut choice. And to a certain extent, you know, I don't think that we can dismiss the, even though Obama himself has been doing just about everything in his power to play it down and come across like the least angry black man in America, and to give this whole image that we're beyond race in this country, quote unquote. Well, we all know, of course, that we aren't, and we all know that, in fact, the campaign is still, certainly the McCain-Palin campaign is very much about race. This is sort of going to be a referendum on whether this is a white republic. And all of the Muslim baiting of Obama, which has been going on, is sort of going to be, you know, it makes it clear that this is also sort of a referendum on whether this is a Christian republic, whether this is a Christian nation, and what exactly the separation of church and state enshrined in the First Amendment means, if in fact it means anything. So, you know, there's a part of me which, I have to confess that there is a part of me which is really avidly rooting for Barack Obama. And, you know, I mean, he's been, once again, in his effort to come across like the least angry black man in America, he's been unwilling to address all of the race baiting and Muslim baiting which has been going on against him. And in fact, ironically, it was Colin Powell, of all people, who actually finally said what needed to be said about the Muslim baiting and said that, you know, well, Obama is not a Muslim, but what if he was? Why, you know, what's wrong with that? Doesn't a Muslim kid have the right to dream of being the president of America, of the United States one day? Ironically, you know, because Barack Obama is in such a position that he can't say it, it fell upon, you know, a Republican mugwump, Colin Powell, who actually said what needed to be said on the question, you know, ironically. So I think that there is actually a lot riding on this on this election, that we could actually be going over the edge, not only into a really, really bad economic crunch in this country if Palin McCain wins, but we could also be going over the edge into something akin to fascism. And once again, I'm not just using that word as like, you know, throwing it around like a manhole cover, as an all-purpose insult. I'm using it in a very, very narrow sense. And I choose my words carefully. Something akin to fascism. And that's bad enough. That's bad enough. And, you know, if there was still a left in this country, if there was still a left in this country, if there was a really, you know, a strong, militant, organized left in this country, I could say, yeah, bring it on. Bring on the final crisis of capitalism. Let's get it over with, you know, and take the real hardcore nihilist position of, you know, yes, heighten the contradictions. Let's go. You know, let's be down for the revolution. But in fact, there is no left in this country. There's practically no left in this country to speak of anymore. And far from having a strong, militant, organized left in this country, we have a strong, militant, organized, armed right in this country, and practically no left. So it seems that right now we're very, very poorly positioned for anything good to come out of a massive crisis of the system. And it seems to me that it's much more likely to go into something akin to fascism if we really have a massive crisis of the system than into a socialist revolution. And that maybe if we begin to step back from the brink, if Obama is elected, and if there really is a sort of a shift back, just as, you know, there was a shift towards a more state interventionist position with FDR in 32, and then a big shift away from it with Reagan in 80. Well, if in 2008 we can have another big shift towards it once again, then at least maybe, you know, the idea of some kind of public oversight of the system will be back within the spectrum of legitimate debate once again, which it has not been since 1980. For more than a generation, it has not even been on the legitimate spectrum of debate. Okay, all of that said, I certainly recognize the risk that if Obama gets in and we do step back from the brink a little bit, then everybody's going to go to sleep and get bought off, and Obama could, you know, ironically, be able to actually get away with doing some really bad things on behalf of corporate power in this country, which and not have you know, his ass held to the fire as a Republican might by the whatever's left of the left, and by if nothing else, by the Democrats in Congress, and certainly you know, when Obama talks about clean coal and nuclear power, it just makes me squirm. And certainly he's not as aggressive about that as John McCain. He's not as aggressive about either of those things as John McCain. And one hopes that maybe when Obama says it, it's just lip service to because he's getting the big corporate money coming in now, and he's got to say that in order to make his paymasters happy. And he doesn't really mean it. Whereas when Obama says it, you know, he really means it. And certainly it sounds a little bit like lip service when Obama says it. And Obama is not calling for building, you know, 70 new nuclear power plants in this country and going whole hog with offshore oil drilling the way McCain is. So it sounds a little bit like lip service when Obama says it, but still he says it, and it's very dangerous because clean coal and nuclear power are both oxymorons, as we know. And it makes me squirm even more when he talks about unilateral military action against Pakistan, which, of course, would be a disaster. Certainly, I don't have any illusions, and I recognize the dangers of an Obama presidency as well. And I confess that I feel torn. And I'd like to know what you all think. Let's take some listener phone calls. 212-209-2950. Predictably, I went on for a half an hour longer than I thought I was going to. Oh, well, I always do, don't I? But let's take some listener phone calls. Let's just play a little bit more music first, and then we'll take some listener phone calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. Probably at exactly the hour at 1 o'clock, we'll take those listener phone calls. But first, I want to play two songs here. I want to, let's see, there's one which I want to, let's play Cut 13. I want to dedicate this one to John McCain. This one's for you, John McCain.
Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. Rum-a-dum-dum, son of freedom. Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. He's the boy who can skin and beat 'em. Throughout the land there's such a cry, and we all know the reason why. Old Rough and Ready's bars and stars beat Mexico's two-legged bars. Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. Rum-a-dum-dum, son of freedom. Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. He's the boy who can skin and beat 'em. He met him on the Rio Grande. He played them Yankee Doodle Dandy. When brave Taylor crossed the line, he made them snort like a steam engine. It's rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. Rum-a-dum-dum, son of freedom. Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. He's the boy can skin and beat 'em. Old Zack kicked up gunpowderation with the Texas annexation. Anyone makes much ado, he'll flog 'em and annex 'em too. Everybody! Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. Rum-a-dum-dum, son of freedom. Rum-a-dum-dum, vote for Taylor. He's the boy can skin and beat 'em.
Yeah, Zachary Taylor. Mexicans, bring them on! Okay, that one was for John McCain. Now let's play one for Barack Obama.
Hurrah for the choice of our nation. Our heroes are brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the boy from Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom true. The pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty too. David's good sling is unerring, the slavocrat giant he slew. So shout if you're freedom preferring, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through. The pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty too. They'll find what by felling and mauling our rail-splitting statesmen can do. The people are everywhere calling for Lincoln and liberty too. And up with our banner so glorious, the star-spangled red, white, and blue. We'll fight till our cause is victorious, for Lincoln and liberty too. For Lincoln and liberty too.
Well, sorry I'm being so corny tonight with the music. Once again, this is Presidential Campaign Song, 1789 to 1996, sung by Oscar Brand on, of course, Smithsonian Folkways. Okay, we're going to plunge into the unknown here on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, where the time is mere seconds to 1 o'clock in the morning. We're going to be taking your listener phone calls for the remaining half hour at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. And I'd like to squeeze in a lot of calls, so get right to the point. Let's keep it rocking along. WBAI, you're on the air. Okay, what part of rocking along didn't you understand?
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
You know, it was a very interesting show, and it seems like it's quite a quandary, and you're a very smart fella, and it seems like you've been on all the squares, and all the squares that I've been, and many others as well. But I'd like to point something out. I heard a speech like last week, and somebody opened the speech with this very brief statement. Said that there are three types of voters in this country. The first is hereditary voters. They vote for a party. They're, you know, Republicans, or they always vote Democrat. The second types of voters are strategic voters. And boy, is that ever a complex world. We're constantly figuring out what's the best strategic move to make with our vote. And I feel that's the long journey that you took me on this evening with you, the strategic analysis of how to make the biggest bang, littlest squeak possible. And then the third type is the voter of conscience. And until we, you know, listen to that and use that in a way to destroy this two-party system, and perhaps bring in instant runoff voting or some types of, you don't necessarily need to have revolution.
Okay, so how are you going to vote?
So what I'm saying, you know who made this speech? I heard it from the lectern that Abraham Lincoln spoke at Grand Army
Cooper Union.
Oh, Cooper Union. And it was Ralph Nader who opened the speech with that.
Yeah.
I've never voted for Ralph Nader before, but his opening comments, and he spoke about the abyss that we will fall into until we start voting our conscience. It's a long slog, man.
So are you going to vote for Nader?
I think actually I will this time, yes. I'm going to vote my conscience, and I generally always have. All right, thanks. Bye.
All right, well, I just like to respond, well, if you're listening. You know, I said this the last time that we discussed these issues. You know, I did vote for Nader twice before, but I cannot vote for Nader ever again. Because he is blocked with Pat Buchanan, and he shared stage with Pat Buchanan, won't repudiate him on his xenophobic nonsense, and in fact equivocates even on building the border wall. He won't, you know. I actually cornered Nader at an event where he was speaking here in New York recently and tried to nail him down, and he would not take a clear stance even against building the border wall. And this is really a no-compromise issue for me. And, you know, I know he talks of his good populist anti-corporate line, but so does Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan also talks a good populist, you know, anti-corporate line, and so did Adolf Hitler back in the day, as I pointed out earlier. Now, I'm not saying that Buchanan... Rather, I'm not saying that Ralph Nader is, you know, like Hitler, but he pals around with Pat Buchanan, and Pat Buchanan is kind of Hitler-esque in his own way. So I can't until he completely repudiates Buchanan, and I don't see any sign of him doing that. I cannot turn the lever for Ralph Nader. I just can't do it. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Turn down your radio and speak up.
Good morning, Bill. This is Zul. Thank you so much for a wonderful rant this morning. I think you gave such a broad and deep backgrounder to the two questions that you ask, and I've been thinking about them and writing about them hard. As a matter of fact, I'm in the midst of writing a piece on triage, replacing the American dream, none of the above, no business as usual, and why depression is our friend. Let me say, just four points of entry in my response to your long rant this morning, and it was just brilliant, just areas in which we agree to enter into this discussion. One, yes, there is no laugh left. Two, the hardened cries of fascism from the left that is left, as opposed to the red-baiting socialist. Three, yes, of course, FDR saved capitalism. And four, and most critically, as you explain, in the change since 1980, We are all Keynesians now. So let me just give you a quick.
No, you mean before 1980, Nixon said we're all Keynesians, and today, since 1980, you could say we're all Friedmanites.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, yeah, exactly. Essentially, you know, whether it's the neoliberal project or the neocon, essentially, not only do we make America safe for capitalism, but we must now make the world safe for capitalism.
All right, so how are you going to vote?
Well, here, you know, this is very, very difficult for me, and this is why I've been writing and working so hard on this. You know, I've been with Ralph Nader for many, many, many years and the Green Party, and been working with Cynthia McKinney closely over the last few years and worked very, very hard on bringing them together and the big buzz in the Green Party convention, not this last year at the nominating convention, but the year before was McKinney-Nader.
But that didn't happen.
Exactly, and,
right.
And critically that, because the slam on Ralph was the Democratic viral ego charge. The slam on Cynthia is flake. The only way to answer that was to put Ralph second to the black woman on the ticket, and the answer to the flake charge is to give her the gravitas.
All right, how are you going to vote?
Okay, I'm voting for none of the above. That's the point of the piece, and this has been very, very hard for me. I'm voting for none of the six ballot qualified presidential candidate.
All right, so how are you going to vote?
None of the above, Bill.
You're going to write in none of the above? Are you going to abstain? Answer the question.
Well, that's very hard. My absentee ballot is I haven't seen yet, and if I can write in exactly none of the above,
All right, is there going to be an October surprise?
Well, you know, Bill, there are always October surprises. I don't have a crystal ball, but
none of us do.
Exactly. But whatever that October surprise is, will be in the scheme of things. So you and I are not going to be terribly surprised. Listen, one last thing, and let me let you get to other calls, because it's so important that we hear a lot of voices on this. Bill, we are at a point today, I think, where not only are we stepping beyond the critical situation that we were in following the Depression and the advent of the Second World War, and I think maybe like you, I would have been the last of the holdouts, but and then also beyond the Civil War, which really answered the last of the unaddressed questions of the American Revolution, I think we may be at a point equivalent to the American Revolution. Quickly, why? We live in a global political economy. Well, there are borders for poor people, women, children, people of the global south, black, brown people. There are no borders for capital. So I think the issue really today, and I don't know if the neoliberal or neocon.
Yes, the issue is what?
The question is no longer capitalism itself, but it's nationalism. Do we have simply another American Revolution? No, we have a worldwide revolution.
Well, gee, thanks.
Yeah, none of the above.
Okay, WBAI, you're on the air. Thank you, Zul. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Okay.
First time listening to your show. I like it a lot. I have two questions for you.
Oh, for me?
Yes. First question is...
I have questions for you, but go ahead.
All right. Are you usually on at this time?
Usually am on at this time, yes.
On a Tuesday night?
You got it, Tuesday midnight to 1:30.
Okay, great. And so then I'm definitely going to listen every day. Every Tuesday. I'll mark that down.
Glad to hear it.
My second question is, I hear you saying about October surprises and, or maybe November or December. What do you mean exactly by that? Are you saying that you wouldn't be surprised if they, suspend the election or even if somebody gets elected by then?
Well, yes.
What can they possibly do?
Well, the initial thing that I've been worried about is that they're going to start bombing Iran. But I'm less worried about that now because I think that they're already so militarily overextended in Iraq and Afghanistan that the Pentagon would essentially veto it. And no matter how much Cheney wants to do it, I think that the State Department and the Pentagon would essentially veto it. But I think I'm quite worried about the economic system just seizing up and us going much, much deeper into financial crisis very, very quickly, and them using that as an excuse to postpone the power transition, just as Giuliani wanted to do after 9/11.
How can they do that legally?
Well, they can't do it legally, although, I mean, it's an ambiguous area, of course, because the Constitution actually does makes, you know, references to states of emergency and so on. So, I mean, there's never really been a real state of exception, so to speak, in this country. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, and, of course, Bush has done the same thing to a certain degree since 9/11.
Right.
But, there's never been a state of exception which really interfered with the actual presidential transition.
Right. But you're afraid.
But I'm afraid that maybe, you know, I don't even like to say it out loud, but I have to confess that I've thought about it.
Okay,
I certainly hope that I'm just paranoid. I certainly hope that I'm just paranoid.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How are you going to vote?
Lesser of two evil, I'm going for Barack.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
You got it.
WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, Bill Weinberg?
Yep.
Yes, I'm going to vote for Cynthia McKinney.
Okay, tell us why.
Well, Barack Obama voted for the Pfizer bill. He voted for the war fund.
I'm sorry, he voted for which?
He voted for the Pfizer bill.
Oh, the Pfizer bill, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And the war funding. And the bailout, which is giving money to irresponsible corporate executives, and his position on Israel stinks. So I have a lot of reasons not to support Barack Obama.
This is true. I wouldn't contest that there are a lot of reasons not to support Barack Obama. But I also think an argument can be made that there is a very, very clear-cut choice between, two politicians, which are exponents of the corporate elite, but one which is an exponent of the more more rational and enlightened element of the corporate elites, and another which is an exponent of the most bellicose and reactionary faction of the corporate elites.
Well, look, Bill, I supported the Democrats back in 2006, and I feel really betrayed, and I'm sure a lot of people do too.
So once bitten, caught twice shy.
Say that again.
Once bitten, twice shy, so to speak.
Well, I just can't do it again.
Okay. Fair enough.
That's my position.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, I missed the first part of the show.
Well, you're catching the second part.
Okay, so I just wanted to tell folks that if they want to do voter protection, to call the ACLU. The New York ACLU is just taking messages as of the beginning of the month. I haven't called them since. And the New Jersey ACLU has like 8 training dates for poll watchers, so because I think that more people of color will not be able to vote in this election than ever before.
Right. I should say that's another thing which I'm really worried about. That's another form which the October surprise could take, is that there's going to be, the same kind of shenanigans like we saw in Florida in 2000 and in Ohio in 2004, and the election is going to be contested. and there's going to be a real showdown between the two parties.
So have you heard about there being, like, a call-out for volunteers for voter protection or what?
No, but tell us.
I haven't, and I had to find it all online and call different organizations and figure it out.
Well, I'm glad you did.
It's not just me.
How are you going to vote? May I ask how you're going to vote?
Oh, well, the lesser of two evils, Barack, because especially in New Jersey, when it was a close one, and I was like, you know, I asked my dad when's the last time a Republican got in a close election, and he said in New Jersey, and he said Reagan. It was all I needed.
Okay. Thank you very much. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio. Speak up.
How you doing, Bill?
Hi.
Just a related question. Are you aware of the brief testimony given by Brad Sherman, representative from California, that he was one of the people that originally voted against the bailout, and they were threatened with martial law?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So,
very ominous, yes.
Yeah, that's not a myth. That's a reality.
Right, I know. Yeah, and there were Iraq combat veteran brigade, which is being called in to patrol the streets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's, you know, it's up on Amy Goodman's website, and Naomi Wolf is making a big deal of it. So, yeah, you know, I'm not the only person out there saying stuff like this. It's true.
Yeah.
How are you going to vote?
Probably Cynthia McKinney.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Why?
Why?
Yeah. Why?
Neither of the other two parties grab me very much. And, you know, even though I know she's not going to be elected, I feel like, I don't know. I mean, too many things. Obama said too many things and voted for too many things that just, I feel like I'd be selling myself out at this point. I'm kind of throwing my hands up in the air. I'm just going to go with, you know.
I understand.
Either that or, you know, I forget the guy's name, but he's the candidate for the Constitutional Party.
Oh, my God.
What? Bad choice?
Yeah, that's a bad choice.
Okay, I'm listening.
The former Taxpayers Party, they're like a radical right, sort of posse comitatus kind of, you know, no, bad news, man.
Yeah, I don't know.
Bad news. Don't, please, if you're going to vote for a third party, vote for the Greens.
Okay, I'm getting desperate.
Don't get that desperate. All right, we're going to keep going with the phone
call. All right, calls. Thanks,
bye-bye. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Oh, I am?
Yes.
Oh, glad to hear that.
Yeah,
it's Sir Edmund the Green calling from the wilds of Ulster County, and there's a pretty major thing that I'm surprised nobody's brought up. Maybe it's just so obvious. You know, that it's not up to any of us. And I'm not saying that because the candidates were picked in smoke-filled rooms or because people like Kucinich didn't even get heard. I'm saying that because none of us are in swing states except for your few Internet listeners, maybe, a few people in Pennsylvania. I don't think Jersey's considered a swing state anymore. So it's just absolutely not up to us. And so we're throwing our vote away if we vote for major party candidates. And at least voting for the Greens gives them a tiny bit of clout, hopefully. Although when Ralph Nader was up here in New Paltz the other day, he made a comment that I thought was rather apropos, unfortunately, that the Greens can't organize their way out of a paper bag. But still, I mean, the Greens are the coolest party going, but there's also communist, socialist, you know, marijuana reform parties, and, you know, it's just pointless to vote in a non-swing state.
All right, Ed, I'm glad you brought that up, and it's definitely a valid point.
All right.
But I do have a countervailing point, which is particularly given the potentiality for voter fraud and contested elections in swing states. There's something to be said for giving Obama the largest popular mandate possible.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that line. I don't buy it. I mean, if the Democrats, like, completely cave in after they've had it stolen twice, then, you know, one more vote or a couple hundred more votes in New York or a state like that where he's going to either have a clear majority or forget it, he's totally lost. I don't think he's going to cut it. I think having them see that, hey, the Greens are really gaining a little strength now, you guys better watch your tail and, you know, start doing what the people want, I think would have more, you know, admittedly also minor clout, but I think that's more significant. And You know, just like you can't vote for a guy that's for a wall, well, I can't vote for a guy that's for clean coal and nuclear power and having a bigger war in Afghanistan and maybe invading Pakistan, you know, that supported the bailout. You know, I did must admit I did give a little money to people going to PA to bring out the vote there because it is a swing state. So I'm not saying I don't hope he wins out of the choices, but
I understand.
Can't bring myself to vote for him. Cynthia McKinney.
All right, I understand. I understand, but I also have a response. Again, you're making definitely legitimate points, and a part of me is totally with you, but there's another part of me which feels like, all right, there's a difference between, like, if I'm going to vote for Ralph Nader, then it's obviously, it's a protest vote. And I sort of feel like he's actually representing me. Whereas if I'm going to vote for Barack Obama, that's not a protest vote. That's, you know, obviously a sort of a hard, cold, strategic kind of vote. And it's obvious that, you know, I'm sort of holding my nose in terms of supporting a party of the rich, which is the Democratic Party.
Well, if I was in a swing state, I would probably do the same. But we're not in a swing state in New York or Connecticut, or I don't think even Jersey anymore.
All right, so you're from beginning.
So strategically, it's better to maybe the Greens get that 5% that gives them a little power next time.
All right, point taken. What about an October surprise?
I'm almost thinking they're going to pull a December or a January surprise, Barack wins and something might happen to him.
I know. I'm worried about that, too.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to keep going.
And I'm hoping the guy does the right thing and he's just playing the game, man. I might hope against hope, but strategically I'm going to be voting. You know, from what you said about the wall, I'm starting to lean towards Cynthia more, but I kind of liked what Nader said in New Paltz, and I do have some Nader signs in the attic, and I can't even get a Cynthia McKinney sign from the Greens. So I'm really torn, but it's between those two.
Okay, thanks for the
call.
All
right. Yeah. Hey, thanks for your wonderful show. Bye.
Yeah. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. Turn down the radio and speak up. Hello. Why do you do this? Why do you do this? Hang on a minute. Wait a minute. Stop. I'm asking you a question. Why do you do this? Is this just like some kind of like weird racist caricature thing that you're doing here? You think it's funny? Is that what's going on? Or I just don't get it. All right, well, you're wasting our time. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio, please. Turn down the radio.
Radio's turned down.
Okay, hi.
Okay. Bill, very quickly, like you said, rocking straight on. I think we left out a fourth category of voter in this country, and that would be the practical voter. Okay.
That's what I meant by the strategic voter, but go ahead.
Right. I mean, it's okay to vote for, you know, for the Independent Party and Green Party or whatever party or however. I mean, you know, you have to understand that and I'm sure these people understand that all they're really doing is dividing a very, very critical vote. Okay, and essentially giving a vote to the Republican Party. You know, and kind of a sidebar would be that, you know, like it or not, there is an unrealized left in this country, and those are the disenfranchised ethnicities and the ghetto communities. I mean, they're there, and they don't approve of the policies, and they suffer as a result of those policies, and like it or not, especially with the advent of the Wasilla washout, these people are up in arms, and I mean, they're ready to go at it. They're not going to have another spate of Jim Crow in the United States. It's not going to happen.
Okay. Well, how are you voting?
I will definitely be voting for Barack Obama, and I'll tell you why. Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack sealed it for me, and the fact that Colin Powell was able to accomplish saying the things that Barack Obama needed to say. For example, if he was a Muslim, what difference would it make? Because Islamism preaches love, kindness, and compassion for all men, and not the radicalism, you know, that they try to make an aspersion that all Muslims are radical, you know, suicide bombs.
All right. So are you worried about an October surprise?
Actually, I had considered it. Okay, but I had thought there would be more like a November surprise under the circumstance where they would try to declare martial law, some sort of financial emergency to suspend the election. But it doesn't look like they're going forth with that. And I think if they don't take that measure, there probably won't be a December or January surprise.
I hope not.
We all hope not.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Bill. Good.
Oops, sorry about that. Sorry to cut you short, but you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, my name is Henry. I'm calling from New England. You mentioned something about Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan. By the way, what's wrong with Chuck Baldwin on the Constitution Party? I don't know much about him, but just briefly give me that.
Oh, God. Well, they're the successor to the taxpayer party, which came out of the radical right and, you know, had links to Posse Comitatus movement and the whole, you know, backlash to the civil rights movement and so on. They're really bad news.
I don't know if they're that bad news.
No,
anyway, I don't know much about them, but I know this. I know that the advisor of John McCain is Henry Kissinger, and the advisor of Obama is Zinu Brzezinski, and they're both globalists. Now, I will tell you this about both those candidates. I don't know if a lot of people realize this and know this, but I called the Senate last year when McCain was sponsoring a bill, and Obama voted for it, and so did McCain, and so did Hillary, and a couple others that were running for president. And it was a bill, this was last year, I was calling Ted Kennedy's office, I mean, that was up and down, and it was a bill that they sponsored, that John McCain sponsored, but Obama voted for it, to give amnesty to 30 million illegal aliens, filth, mostly from
South America. Did you say filth? Is that the word you used?
Yeah, right.
Okay, goodbye. WBAI, you're on the air. Go ahead and have fun voting for the taxpayer party, Mr. Filth. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, I thought that the United States of America, all people were equal. And if they don't let Nader and Cynthia McKinney speak at these debates because they're afraid of them, that's the truth. They're afraid they'll bring...
Okay, how are you going to vote, Monroe?
When I heard Barack Obama said, yes, we can, I was thrilled. But since then, I've been disheartened. And
so who are you going to vote for, Monroe? I want to get on to some other calls. Who are you going to vote for, Monroe?
And New York State would be to give Cynthia McKinney my vote, although I do admire Nader.
All right, so you're going for McKinney?
Huh?
You're going for McKinney?
I guess I will, hoping that masses of New York Staters will vote for Barack Obama.
Right, but you're not going to be with them because you're going to be voting with McKinney. Okay, WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? You're on the air. Please turn down your radio and speak up.
Okay, I'll be very quick. let's see. Okay, Obama... He's for alternative energy, and when he says he said he would take a look at offshore drilling and nuclear energy, and then McCain barked back and said, "Yeah, he's going to take a look." Well, he was just trying to be as careful as he can. Anyway, what I wanted to mention, you talked about revolution. WBAI had an excellent presentation about there's going to be this Sunday at 1 p.m. at Schomburg Center. There's going to be a very serious symposium on the possibilities of having a revolution.
You're talking about the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is a doctrinaire Maoist organization which supports the Shining Path in Peru and thinks that human rights are a bourgeois construct and are essentially an evil totalitarian cult.
At the Schomburg Center?
Yes, yes, yes. The RCP, Revolutionary Communist Party. Bad news, in my estimation.
I didn't hear them say that.
No, well, of course they don't say that. What do you think? They're going to come out and say, yes, we're a totalitarian cult.
Because the names that they gave were, you know, people that you hear of. And
yeah, right, I know. Well, a word to the wise, okay? A word to the wise. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you.
Who are you going to vote for?
Oh, Obama, because what else? You know, I'd like to vote for Nader or Cynthia McKinney, but...
But you're going to vote for Obama.
Yep.
All right. We're going to see if we can squeeze in one or two more calls. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
I'm a registered Green Party, but I'm going to vote for Obama.
Okay. Are you worried about an October surprise?
I think we're already in a surprise. I think the reason is because, you know, even Dennis Kucinich, you remember how he was screaming and yelling, "Wake up, America"?
Yeah.
I think the subtext of that was, listen, I don't believe in nuclear power either, but he's our only hope. I don't.
Okay,
think
but how, what do you mean we're already in a surprise?
Well, it depends on who you are and where you are economically.
They haven't started a war yet. I mean, they have. Well, you're already in two wars.
You mean a martial law?
There isn't a real state of emergency or a new military escalation. That's what I'm worried about.
Okay, that's what you meant by a surprise?
Yeah.
A martial law or because of
some
what?
Kind of real state of emergency, something big and dramatic.
I wouldn't put it past George Bush trying to pull something
all
like
right, that.
All
right, let's see if we can squeeze in one more call.
Thank you, bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. Last call. Make it a good one.
Yeah, great. I was have a comment as to why maybe Colin Powell endorsed Barack. Maybe it's because in the back of his mind he's going to be indicted for the war crimes or leading us into the Iraq war.
He didn't lead us into the Iraq war. You could argue that he committed war crimes in the Iraq war, but he certainly didn't lead us into. Actually, no, you're right. He sort of did lead us into it. I stand corrected. What am I saying? Of course he did. No, you're right. But
of course. They lied.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what that has to do with. I was thinking of 1991 and his role back then. But no, this time around, you're absolutely right. Of course he did.
So it might be in the back of his mind that, hey, let me get with Obama because this guy looks like he's going to win. And, hey, maybe we can smooth things out.
Well, but look, I mean, even if somebody were to bring war crimes charges at The Hague against...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.